You're listening to the Right Turn Radio podcast. Tonight, I am honored and a little afraid to say that my co-host is Joshua Bennett Johnson.
Heyo.
Hi, Josh. Josh is a co-worker at Right Turn with me.
And I am.
He's also an author. He's a father. Uh-huh. He is wearing the coolest hat I've seen in
Keep
a while.
Keep going. Keep going.
And one of the most handsome men ever to grace radio. They'll never know.
John, I'm not going to disagree with you, but I'm happy to be co-hosting with you tonight.
Well, we're missing Abby. She's on vacation. Tonight's show is about mindfulness, Josh,
yes.
And recovery. And I was thinking about it on the way over. I was talking to a good friend of ours, Patty Mason, who's
yes.
in the hospital recovering from hip.
Poor Patty.
And we love Patty, and we're sending her good vibes tonight. But the first, she was talking, we were talking about pain, and the first time I ever was introduced to mindfulness was when I went to a program to deal with some physical pain.
Okay.
And I learned a little about mindfulness. It was the first time I ever meditated. And it really helps. It really helps. So tonight we have Dr. Larry Peltz, author of the new book, The Mindful Path to Addiction Recovery, A Practical Guide to Regaining Control Over Your Life. So it's a great book. Dr. Peltz is the medical director of the Bournewood Caulfield Center, a drug and alcohol treatment facility in Woburn, Mass. He has worked with more than 10,000 recovering addicts over the course of his career. He's up for sainthood pretty soon.
I'd say so.
And he is also a trained teacher of mindfulness-based stress reduction. He speaks regularly to mental health professionals about mindfulness and recovery. Welcome to Right Turn Radio,
Welcome, Dr. Peltz.
Thanks. It's great to be here with you guys.
Dr. Peltz, why did you write this book?
That's a good question. I was invited to write it. My dad had actually just died, and I got this was about 5 years ago. I got a call from a friend who had written a couple of books, and he said, "This editor approached me. Would you like to write a book about mindfulness and addiction?" I'd spoken on the subject. I guess these acquiring editors find you. And my first thought was, right, that's going to happen. but my dad had just died. My kids were away at college. And I'd done this for 25 years. And I thought it would be nice to collect all of this. And something and make it useful to people.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
What is mindfulness for the purposes of what you're writing about?
Well, mindfulness is it's both a skill and an attitude. It's actually a deceptively simple skill that can be learned by anybody, and basically it's living one moment at a time, which is exactly what we don't do. We tend to be always in the past, in the future, mm-hmm. telling a story, judging, comparing, and so this is one moment at a time. It's also about being more embodied, more in the body, less in the head. And it's also about knowing what you can control and what you can't. You can sort of hear the resonance of the Serenity Prayer in that. This is actually a technology for the Serenity Prayer. It's a way of actually operationalizing it. So it's basically what mindfulness is. It's a balanced awareness of moment-to-moment experience with acceptance.
Living in the now, that sounds Buddhist. Is it Buddhist in origin?
Yes. It's the Buddha did not invent mindfulness. Okay. There's mindfulness in all traditions. There's mindfulness in Judaism, in Christianity, in Islam. Many people practice mindfulness, you know, naturally, people that can naturally focus. But the Buddha put together a set of teachings, actually his disciples did, that is sort of a complete practice for making this real in our lives. So it comes out of Buddhist psychology, but it's not, you don't have to be a Buddhist
sure.
to do this.
So the mind-body connection, how is this possibly helpful in recovery? Like, tell us how that interfaces with mindfulness.
Right. Well, people who come in to treatment, now my population may be not totally typical, but it's actually becoming more typical. It's a dual diagnosis program, which means addiction plus depression, addiction plus bipolar disorder, anxiety disorder, attention deficit disorder, whatever. And more we're seeing this is, and I suspect at Right Turn you're seeing a lot of this as well, that people have something other than just that they're an alcoholic. That's becoming more and more rare. So why people come into treatment is, in our program, we've been doing it now for 16 years, and we're nice, but that's not why they come.
Sure.
You know, they come because they're in a mess. And people come basically everyone who comes has basically three or four things about them. Everyone's life isn't going well.
Mm-hmm.
They're living in their heads. Their energy systems are out of whack. Pretty much everybody. Energy is too low, too high. They're all over the place, right? So, and they've been doing things that are going in the wrong direction, right? So that if, for example, you touch a hot stove and take your hand away, you do not need to go to day treatment for that, right? But if you have a strategy, and it could be alcohol, or it could be drugs, or it could be food, or work, or gambling, that works for a while, that has you feeling a sense of tremendous power, and then it doesn't work as well, That's a problem because in the process of using the drug over time, capacities begin to erode and people are not thinking straight.
We tell our clients when they come in, they're used to these very high highs and these very low lows, and the hope is that we can get them back to baseline, sometimes with a little medication and a lot of therapy and a lot of support. Is mindfulness effective for that, for getting people back to that baseline?
Yes. I mean, what treatment is and what we in our program is, we call it four pillars of treatment. It's recovery, psychotherapy, medicine, if you need it,
mm-hmm.
not everyone does, but many do, and mindfulness practice. So recovery is, don't be so alone with your problem.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, there's 12-step recovery, but it's a much really broader idea than that. It's because people are very alone and in their heads. Okay, so you could call it higher power, you could call it God, you could call it spirituality, you could call it
love.
Right? You could call it team. You could call it community. Whatever you're comfortable calling it, that's recovery. You're not alone. Then psychotherapy is, how do I understand my problem and what do I do about it? How do I take responsibility for it? How do I avoid responsibility for it? See, we all do this. We want to grow up and we don't want to grow up. You might have noticed that, right? There's a certain, growing up is better, but it's difficult.
Sure.
So it's not for everybody. Right. So what are your strengths? What are your difficulties, conflicts, grief, trauma? How do you take responsibility for that or not? That's psychotherapy.
Yeah.
Then medicine, symptom relief. Doesn't cure you, but it's good for things like depression, anxiety, mood swings, thought disturbances, attentional disturbances, certain cravings. That's about it. It gives you a chance to think straight and do the other components of treatment. And then the fourth is mindfulness, which is this moment-to-moment awareness. And it works particularly well with the other components. It informs all of the other components, and hopefully we'll get into how that works.
Is it difficult? Because we all know here that people in early recovery are basically vessels for cycling and perseverating thoughts and so is it hard to calm that mind, or at least to make that mind aware? Is that difficult?
Yes. That's why we need this integrated approach.
Sure.
So these four pillars of treatment, it's a little like if you build a deck, you put these four piers in the ground and then you build a platform. It's a little like that.
Yes.
Or you could also see it as a toolbox.
Well, and we see more and more clients who want a more holistic approach, more of a mind, body, spirit, community approach, which I think speaks to this, to the yes. idea of these four pillars.
That's right. So I wonder if we might want to just give you all and the listeners a sense of what this is.
I love that idea where, when we come back from the break, We're going to talk a little more about mindfulness. We're going to hear it in practice and how it works, you know, because the most practical application of this, you said it at first, Doctor, it's a really simple thing once you get in practice of doing it. It's a really simple thing to apply to a lot of things, not just addiction and recovery, but there's a lot of places that this can help and get and help us get better. So when we come back, we're going to do some mindfulness exercises. Sweet. Josh?
I'm ready.
So we wanted to hear some personal experience, Larry. Can you give us some examples of how mindfulness has worked for some of your clients?
I'm actually moved to tell you about one that's just in process to just give a sense of how it how we work with it in the program. This is a young woman that came because it's not that common for us because eating disorders often go to different programs, but she has a binge eating disorder and she identifies as an addict, which not all eating disorders do. And I think she looks fabulous, but she has a sense that there's something wrong with her. And she really grew up with a sense that she could not, she would never equal her mother and her sister, who were quite beautiful, that kind of thing. And this, and so she works out, but here and there she falls short, and some of this is around the inner pressure, the self-esteem issues. So she's made a nice connection. She's she came in, and the other morning, in the morning group, she revealed that she had had a binge. So we're interested in this. You know, we don't, or if people drink, we don't ask them to leave the program. Sure. We're interested in what in the world happened, right? So she had a fight with her mother. She was asking for help of some kind. She didn't get the support. She felt unsupported. And so I wanted to slow it down. So I said, well, do you remember what happened? She says, well, I remember I clenched my teeth. I cried. I started to worry about how I was get to work. Apparently she needed a ride. And then since they weren't talking, I said, how are you feeling? She says, I was feeling tired. I had thoughts of eating. She's been in the program for a little while, so she didn't want to just indulge it. So she did the laundry, and she distracted for a while. And she had more thoughts, anxiety, an urge, and then she eventually reacted and ate. Okay.
So you did. You kind of dissected. You slowed it down, like you said, and you looked at her thought process.
That's right. Her thought process and her physical and her body process.
Sure. Because you mentioned that she was tired. She was sort of feeling vulnerable physically.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So that's helpful. Why does that work?
Well, because the tendency is for people to be in their heads. Mm-hmm. And when they relapse, they feel like a loser. Mm-hmm. And this doesn't help because it's discouraging and it doesn't feel like they're getting anywhere.
Yeah.
So if we can begin to slow things down, and because the problem is then you've got to be good. Well, many of these people have been good. They've tried that. This young woman has been good plenty, but just doesn't work, right? So when we slow it down, we hear they say hungry, angry, lonely, tired. I'm hearing them all in this story. You know, I clenched my teeth. I was tired. I was worried. She felt the disconnect with her mother, et cetera, right? And so, and then she did some good things. You know, she actually tried to distract, and then the anxiety, the renewed anxiety, then an urge, and then she ate. But there's something good about what she did, so we can highlight that. Mm-hmm. And then, for example, in this case, I talked a little bit about how you work with cravings. They're cravings and urges, right? They're not exactly the same. A craving is a wanting feeling. An urge is more like moving towards something. It's more like, an urge is more like the alarm in a stress reaction. It's like it's just short of an impulse, right? So there's craving, there's urge, there's impulse, there's anxiety. So we'll ask people, what happened? Do you have any cravings? And they confuse that with the anxiety. It's not the same thing.
Sure.
That's really
important. So by slowing this down, you can begin to see how this works. And then we talked about there's basically three methods, one of which she used. One is stay busy, distract, right? That's a nice way of moving the energy, mm-hmm. right? Another is think through, they say think through the drink. It could be think through the drug or the binge, right? I want to binge, I want to drink, but what's going to happen if I do that?
Right.
And many people are able to hold off the acting it out by saying, I don't want to go there. I don't want to do that. And the third method is what we call urge surfing. Now, this is a mindfulness technique that uses the breath as a surfboard because the urges and cravings are both like a wave. They rise, they crest, and they fall, mm-hmm. right? Now, so if you use your breath as a surfboard, you can ride with it. It takes more than one breath. It might take 10 minutes, but by staying with it, you'll notice the experience of in the body, and then that these things don't last forever. Because
do people ever tell you about how long these cravings and urges last when they employ this technique to urge surf?
It's at least several minutes.
Okay.
Right. It can be as much as 15 minutes, but it doesn't necessarily have to be that long.
Sure.
So it's important to point out that you're not saying ignore this stuff. I mean, that's part of the mindfulness thing.
Right.
You don't ignore it. You don't sweep it under the carpet. You acknowledge, but then you employ these tools that, you know, of mindfulness to breathe, to observe these things and,
yes.
and bring that into play.
That's right.
So how, if Josh and I wanted to have a simple exercise that we could do for mindfulness. Say Josh is mad at me for stealing his office
and I
with
am.
A client.
Right. Yeah.
And I need
this to, is real life.
Right. So what can we do?
Okay. So this is a very simple exercise that I call touch points. And I'll take you through it. And people can try this along with us and then we'll check in about it. So you might notice your body sitting, okay? You might say notice your feet making contact, toes or the balls of the feet, right? And then the legs, the butt in the chair, maybe the back is making contact, the arms, hands. So those are your touch points. Now, there are even more touch points. There are some around the mouth, teeth, lips, tongue. If you close your eyes, you'll feel the eyelids, right? So just, if you would, guys, just direct your attention to those touch points. And you can do it the way I did it, one at a time, feet, legs, back, etc. Or you might be drawn to one area that feels particularly grounding or centering, has you feeling very present or stable. So just directing your attention to your touch points. Okay. All right, great. So what did you notice doing that?
It quieted my mind, quite frankly. Just being able to put my focus into different, you know, physical manifestations of how my body was feeling. I was focusing, like, on my torso. It allowed the mind to sort of quiet down a little bit.
So now you weren't thinking very much.
I wasn't thinking.
Now, are you surprised by that?
Well, I was paying attention only to the sensation of the feeling in my back against a chair.
Right.
So I suppose it was a thought, but it was more like thinking about the experience of the feeling.
Well, right. That's, you don't actually have to think. You can just notice.
Sure,
that's correct. But is it surprising to you, Josh, that you weren't thinking much? Or not particularly.
I don't know if it's surprising. It was a different sort of sensation, though, right. When I think about how I mentally experienced it.
All right, great.
For sure.
Great.
Yeah.
Yes.
What happens with me, and I do this one at least once a week because I have a facilitated group where we do this, but if the first 20 seconds I'm on the radio, we're very aware of everything that's
yes.
going around, and then I shut my eyes and I try to kind of center, and I always try to imagine myself melting into the chair because, you know, to relax my shoulders but keep my spine straight, and kind of trying to just imagine myself melting into the chair, and that brings me, it makes me relax.
It reminds me of the Grateful Dead.
Don't even get me started
sure.
on that.
Very psychedelic.
When we come back, we're going to talk more about specific exercises we can do. We're going to ask Dr. Peltz about long-term using this in recovery for people in recovery and other areas we can use it in. You're listening to Right Turn Radio. We're talking about mindfulness and addiction recovery, but also just mindfulness, because this stuff works. We were talking during the break about how it works across many different platforms and areas. Our guest is Dr. Larry Peltz, author of the new book, The Mindful Path to Addiction Recovery. We want to hear from you if you want to call in, 617-266-6868. I'm feeling a little more focused, a little more relaxed. Dr. Peltz, can you talk about what you did there?
Well, I wanted to say a word or two, lest anyone be discouraged, because you guys had experiences that I would say are impressive. That is, we did this for maybe about 15 seconds, so right. Then people aren't thinking. We're thinking all the time. Right. Or relaxing in 15 seconds. Well, this didn't cost you anything, did it? No. So this is something that takes practice. It takes practice. But these are but if your mind is not quiet, the idea of mindfulness practice is not to quiet your mind. That will happen as a matter of course. But in the early going, I mean, my mind was all over the place when I first started meditating. 90 miles an hour down the freeway figuring out everything. I didn't know it, but I have had a thinking addiction. So it gradually settled over time.
I have the same thing. The first few seconds sometimes the first few minutes of meditation, I can't stop thinking. And yeah. It's like, I should really be doing, I need to be da-da-da-da-da. And then eventually, through no work of my own, that goes away.
Yes.
And people are pushed away from that sometimes because they think they're not doing it correctly.
Yes.
I tried meditating once and it didn't work.
Yeah.
I hear it all the time.
All the time. That's so
and then
funny.
I have a gentleman who's a client who says that if he puts say an hour's worth of time into meditation and he reaches that point of, it sounds kind of cliche, but that Zen sort of feeling of 2 seconds of just complete thoughtlessness, it was all worth it. That's what he says. It was all worth it.
I know you've worked with some other populations
sure.
on this.
So you worked in the prison system.
Yes.
When I think of a population, and it's a knee-jerk reaction, I think, when I think about this, but were they resistant to it? Were they open to it? What was that experience like? Because I figure it must have just been a fascinating population to work
yes,
with.
Yes, it really was. And a lot of it was my own experience of walking in and how much fear I experienced just being inside. But then when I was with these guys, there's a lot of mental illness, a lot of struggle. In fact, a lot of them look a lot better inside than they did on the street. And in terms of openness, the young guys often are not very open.
Okay.
The older guys, more so, because they're more respectful, but also what they'd been doing hadn't been working. So they were more open to it. But the point is not whether they buy into it. Take my word for anything. The point is whether they'll try something and then have an experience.
Sure.
So one that comes to mind is it was a young guy who was, he's a young Latino guy who's fairly dismissive of it. But then one day after class, maybe after the fifth week, this was an 8-week program, he said, he came up to me after class and said, I was in my cell. I had this tremendous pain in my neck. And so I had nothing to do. So I just sat on my bed and I just followed my breath, just noticed my breath right at my belly and just followed it. And the pain went away. Now, I didn't have to convince him of anything. He saw that. He saw that that his tight muscles relaxed. He got a relaxation response.
Amazing. That's awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. There was another guy who was out. They were shaking down his cell. He told me the story. He was sitting outside on his mattress, and he was in a rage. But he was pretty far along in the class, and he knew that he'd gotten in trouble with his temper before. So he decided to just take a few breaths, and then he lied down, and he did a body scan, just scanned his body from bottom to top. And then pretty soon he was relaxed, and then pretty soon they were done. And it was a new experience for him to actually hold his anger, watch it come and go, relax. And these guys often, a lot of nice guys, not all, but a lot of nice guys who wound up behind the walls because they did something to scare people.
Right. And would you say a lot of stories of addiction, of substance abuse?
Yes, sure. Yes. There was a tremendous amount of it. We didn't hear a lot about that, but it was a we were a companion program to a Spectrum House was doing this program on addiction and criminogenic behavior. And one day the Department of Correction coordinator said to me, he said, "You know, that is a very solid curriculum there. But without what you guys are teaching them, the first time they get angry, it's all out the window."
Hmm.
So they were, yes, they need to learn some things about substance abuse and their tendencies, but they also needed some skills to make it real.
Sure. And to manage their anger, it sounds like.
Yes.
Yeah. I can't imagine a more difficult place to kind of practice this stuff. And so you're telling us that, you know, it works in that environment too.
Well, right. It's a very tense environment, and there's a lot of. We were actually also in the women's prison, and one thing that we discovered was I didn't teach there, but when they would do the body scan, the teacher, and these were women, they discovered that the body scan people would lie on their back on mats, nobody could move. And what we discovered was that a lot of these people had been sexually abused.
Hmm.
And so the ability to the ease with which people were triggered was quite dramatic.
It's powerful. Yeah, I would have to assume it's just an interesting sample set. Is there a demographic that mindfulness that you've found is a demographic that's more sort of, you know, drawn to mindfulness? Is it more appealing? For certain,
you know, I think
younger,
this is,
older.
I think this is an equal opportunity. I mean, where, as I was saying before, some people are naturally mindful. I know people.
My 2-year-old, for instance, sure.
Right.
Living in the moment.
Right, and can stay present and focused, but. Many of us really aren't that way. I certainly wasn't. I needed a lot more help. And our minds are always going at, we always want something. We're hardwired to seek pleasure and avoid pain.
In your book, you talk about getting a feeling or getting rid of a feeling.
Yes.
In
yes.
relation to addiction.
Well, there's three reasons people use drugs, and those are to get a feeling we want, to get rid of a feeling we don't want, or to escape. Okay. And it turns out that these are the same ways, according to the Buddha, that we suffer. We suffer because we hold on to things longer than they want to be held on to, right? We push them away faster than they want to go. And, I mean, thank God it's Friday, but last I checked, Friday always turns into Monday, right? Or I can't wait for my vacation. Well, yeah. That's going to end, right?
Yeah.
That's a losing strategy.
Yeah.
So, holding on, grasping, aversion, and delusion. Delusion is like mistaken beliefs or spacing out or dissociating. These are the ways in which we do not tolerate our experience. We resist our experience. So drug use, ironically, is a way of feeling better, but it creates more of a problem.
So a lot of people with long-term recovery often talk about this, and, you know, they say the very thing that I was using to kind of get that spiritual feeling, the thing that I was chasing, that first shot of heroin or whatever that I was chasing, I found in these practices and meditation, and it's not killing me, by the way. It's not taking me, you know, and ruining my life and making it unmanageable. This is a great subject. When we come back, We're going to talk a little more with Dr. Larry Peltz about his new book, The Mindful Path to Addiction Recovery, A Practical Guide to Regaining Control Over Your Life. You're listening to Right Turn Radio. We'll be back after the break.
Dr. Peltz, I had a question. When I think of addicts and alcoholics in early recovery going through these just miserable symptoms of irritability and sleeplessness and anxiety and these sudden mood swings, depression, sure, all that, how can we practically apply some of these techniques that you talk about in your book to help people through that roller coaster ride that's early recovery?
Yes. Well, for some people, it's hard to sit still. When I first started teaching this, I was working inpatient, actually, and inpatient, everyone is either real droopy with no energy, or they're real shaky, or they're kind of a little crazy, like all over the place, right? One version of that. Well, it turns out walking practice is a very good practice for this kind of thing.
So just walking around.
Walking balances energy. And I'm talking about mindful walking now.
Tell us what that is.
Mindful walking is, and you can do it at any speed. You know, in meditation centers, they walk very slow, lifting, moving, placing. You get very slow, can coordinate it with the breath. But you can also walk, you sort of amble slowly to the bathroom, or you walk a little more quickly to your car, or you walk around the parking lot. So you would just notice things like, notice your feet striking the ground, notice the arms swinging, notice the posture, breathing, feel the breeze, feel the sun. Now, when the mind comes in, you just notice that. So you might hear a sound, right? And then you just notice that. If you start thinking about that sound, the instruction is to come back. If you see a red BMW drive by, and you feel the energy of it, that's fine. If you start thinking, oh God, I'd like to have a car like that, that's thinking, right? That's not meditating. So we would then come back and be in the body. And it turns out that this walking is a nice way to balance energy. So it's good for low energy states and high energy states.
Okay. What about people who have like racing thoughts when they're trying to go to sleep at night?
Well, many of these people need medicine.
Okay.
Right. But even when medicine doesn't do the whole job, that's why there's four components to this program and not one. What I do is I sit on the side of my bed and I'll just follow my breath at my belly. And just like you guys experience some version of it, the thoughts start settling. It's a little like the mud starts settling. If you had a jar full of a bottle full of water and sand and you shook it up, what would you see?
You'd see a shaken up jar of sandy water.
Right, exactly. And if you set it down on the counter and left it there, what would happen?
It would begin to settle.
It would clear.
Sure.
That's right.
Sure.
That's how we are. Now, you're right. It would begin to settle. That's really important because I tried this, and one of the things I noticed was it didn't settle as fast as I liked.
Not right away.
It didn't happen.
Yeah.
And so what we tend to do is we shake it a little to make it settle faster. That
sure.
doesn't work.
Instant gratification.
That's exactly right.
Of the human
but
species.
But if we
here.
Sit with it long enough, these things will settle.
Okay.
Right.
I like that. That's a nice metaphor.
Is there an intersection between 12-step recovery and mindfulness?
Yes. Oh, yeah. Well, you know how they say one day at a time?
Mm-hmm.
This is one moment at a time.
Yeah.
It's the microscopic version. It breaks down experience into smaller bites. A day can be very long for an addict. A Saturday, wake up, it's just endless, right? But if you begin to structure the time, if you begin to use some of these moment-to-moment techniques, it's more workable.
And is it helpful to have a guide in doing some of these exercises, these touch point exercises,
yes,
and the body scan and the walking meditation? Is it something that's pretty easily implemented into just your personal experience?
Well, I think like any skill, this takes practice.
There's also, I want to mention that there's apps that you can get, the guided meditation apps, there's mindfulness apps you can get for your smartphone that will that will take you through this stuff. And
yes, in fact, I can give a couple of references. Christopher Germer is a psychologist who wrote a book called The Mindful Way to Self-Compassion. His website has downloadable and meditations that you can listen to.
Very cool.
Online. Ronald Siegel, themindfulnesssolution.com. You can get meditations on there.
This is, one of the great kind of tools in the toolbox for addiction recovery, and it's something that can last over a person's entire recovery and benefit their lives. What other areas of life do people use mindfulness in that they're finding benefits in?
Well, we were talking before about parenting. It's a lot harder to be a parent than
brother.
A therapist. I'm both, and it's not even close.
No.
So parenting brings up all kinds of feelings, frustration, disappointment, anxiety. To be able to slow down and ground ourselves, we're going to speak from a calmer, more centered place and get a much better response. In relationship, we tend to be reactive. This is a very challenging mindfulness practice to what we call effective communication. So there's the very simple model is, I feel blank when you.
Right.
Okay. And this is, but it requires some centering. There was one guy in our program who he talked about a series of difficult encounters with his girlfriend. And he came in one day. He'd been with us for a while. And in the heat of the moment, she says to him, you are such an...
Ooh.
And then he says, you may not agree with me, but you can no longer speak to me like that.
Wow.
Wow.
Now, this was the fruits of his doing these practices and being able to speak from a more grounded place. Now, he couldn't control how she reacted. Well, she reacted well. But he couldn't control that. What he could control was having respect for himself and for their relationship.
And being in the moment. His voice.
Yes. Yeah. Because there's two things we can control, where we direct our attention and our actions. That's it.
And being in the moment and awareness of that. I think the definition in the book was awareness of the mind-body process in the present moment with acceptance. I love that.
Oh, I love it.
I love it. I want to thank Dr. Lawrence Peltz for coming into the studio, talking with Right Turn Radio. We want to have you back to talk more about this. His new book, his book that came out in 2013, The Mindful Path to Addiction Recovery, A Practical Guide to Regaining Control Over Your Life. Thank you so much for coming in, Dr.
It's
Peltz.
It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you, Dr. Peltz. That was great.
I learned something today, Josh. I learned, first of all, I like being on the radio with you.
I like being on the radio, too.
I like sharing an office with you.
With me, yeah.
But don't ever steal my office, and don't steal things from my office.
Sure.
Because when you do that, it makes me feel like...
I'm glad you're using your mindful voice.
I learned something. This is good stuff. Any kind of tool, like we said, that you can have in the arsenal of stuff to take with you into recovery is a powerful thing.
Sure, and really just into life.
Into life. Yeah. This is for everybody. Thank you for listening to the Right Turn Radio podcast. Please check us out on Facebook and at www.right-turn.org.